Well, with that committee meeting in order, members, we're going to continue this morning with the overview of House File 3603. This would be the governor's tax and revenue initiative. So, Commissioner, if you'd be so kind, as not exactly sure where we left off, but I'm sure you remember.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dan Solomone, Commissioner of Revenue. I believe we're ready to talk about Sections 10, 12, and 16, which is the governor's proposal for a military pension income subtraction. This is a subtraction from Minnesota taxable income and from the alternative minimum tax for pension and retirement income included in federal taxable income that are received for service in the armed forces of the United States. This subtraction is phased in over 4 years, starting at, in tax year 06, 25% subtraction up to $7,500. In tax year 07, a 50% deduction up to, subtraction up to $15,000. In 2008, 75% up to $22,500. And in 2009, a 100% subtraction with no limit. The fiscal cost of this proposal in the 06-07 biennium is $4.1 million. By our estimates, this would affect between 17,000 and 18,000 veterans. The average benefit for officers would be about $1,600, and for enlisted members, it would be $720 when fully phased in. In fiscal year 03, the number of people receiving military pay in Minnesota was about 13,690. It's important to note that the proposal includes a subtraction for survivor benefits and for disability pensions. When the proposal is fully phased in by 2010, the cost would be about $19 million.
Any questions on this provision? Commissioner, can you just explain briefly how the phase-in is occurring?
In terms of the schedule, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Tax year 06, it's a 25%, a subtraction of 25% of pension income up to $7,500. And then in 07, it's 50% up to $15,000. In 08, tax year 08, it's 75% up to $22,500. And in tax year 2009, it is 100%.
Okay. What's the number of the bill, Mr. Chairman?
This is House File 3603. We're on which... should be in your packets from last week, Representative Anderson. And this is, Commissioner, which article? This is actually in Article 10. Commissioner Solomone, what other states currently have this provision in law?
Mr. Chair, I think House staff has done a nice survey that I've had a chance to look at, and I can try to summarize that for you. Currently, Minnesota fully taxes all pension income and makes no distinction between military and private pensions. We are among 8 states that do that. House staff has broken down the treatment of pension income into 2 categories. And this is from a recent article in the state tax notes. And basically, there are 36 states that treat private and military pensions in the same manner. Eight of those tax all of the income, and that's including Minnesota. Five exempt all pension income, whether it's military or private. 14 exempt some pension income, and there are a number of different provisions. In general, it ranges, the exemption ranges from about $6,000 to $40,000. In some cases, it's based on age. Nine states have no income tax, but tax, and those include states that tax, for this comparison, states that tax interest and dividends. So that's the 36 states that treat military and private pensions the same way. There are 14 states that tax military pensions more favorably. Three tax all private pensions but exempt some military pensions. Five states plus the District of Columbia tax all private pensions but exempt some military. The first category was taxing all private and exempting all military. And as I just said, five plus D.C. tax all private and exempt some military. Four exempt some private and exempt all military. I'm sure you're tracking with me here, Mr. Chair. It's pretty complicated to summarize in a short way the various treatment of pension income.
There's a variety.
I'll refer you to the state tax notes article and Joel's wonderful summary of that.
Okay. There's a variety. Let's just leave it at that. There's a vast variety.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to suggest that we have a printed handout if you want to go through this again sometime. But how many states exempt Social Security pension money? Since we're on that subject, there are some of us that are going to be, don't have military pensions, but will have Social Security.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can't answer that at this point. We could certainly get that information for you. It obviously varies from state to state.
Right.
And we have, I think, partially conformed to the taxation of Social Security at higher levels of income.
Well, Mr. Chairman, why are we dwelling on military here? I mean, hasn't the governor been over there visiting with the troops enough? Doesn't that take care of his political obligations?
Commissioner, did you want to respond to why the military pension exclusion?
I will only say that the governor certainly has great respect for the military and wants to do something for them. They're making, for those who are serving actively, are making a significant sacrifice. They're away from their families. I think beyond that, I know there are folks here from the military who are, I think, planning to testify later, and maybe they can elaborate on some of the motivation.
Representative Hart.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, have there been any efforts for a military bonus for so many days spent here and there and overseas and what have you?
Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of anything that recently in that area.
Thank you.
Representative Lucheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Salamone, I agree with Representative Earhart here in that I think we should do something for veterans and for those active soldiers. But I'm, you know, a lot of us on the tax committee, and I think you yourself agree that in general you don't want to use the tax code to do these sorts of things if you can avoid it. You would be better off just appropriating money to the veterans. And can you tell me why you're proposing this approach as opposed to just direct benefits or just outright appropriations to serve the same constituency rather than using the tax code to do it this way? Kind of the way Representative Earhart, why not just do a bonus or just give them money outright?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lincheski, you're right. In general, it's been my view that direct appropriations are more preferable to tax expenditures. I don't know the logic of picking the tax system in this case. And maybe if you get some testimony on that.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Clark Dyrud. I'm Commissioner for Department of Veterans Affairs. I wanted to address a couple of points very quickly. I think Representative Earhart was mentioning about the bonus. We've always given a bonus from World War I forward. There's been no talk yet. It's too early. Typically, you wait for a little while before you introduce bonus language, and I see Representative Anderson has been very instrumental in that over the years, so I think he's well aware of that. The question as to why this particular item is up for consideration. Their military retirees are really a great source of economic source for a state. There are, in Minnesota, only 4% of our veterans populations are military retirees. The national average is 8%. And, of course, some states where there's bases, they have a much higher percentage. But generally speaking, we have just about the lowest percentage of military retiree for the veterans population. Military retirees come into they leave the military around age 40, and they are well-educated. They are outstanding citizens. They are... they start working in second jobs, and you have a long career ahead of them in the state if you can attract them to the state. They also obviously have spouses many times who also are working and contributing, et cetera, et cetera. So there is a large benefit to attracting the military retiree upon leaving the service. Military retirees are very used to moving. Some of them have moved literally 15, 20 times in their career. They also have a very good network. They are very much aware of what the benefits are around the country as far as taxing. And so it is no problem for them to move to a place that would give them more favorable tax status. So those are just some of the points. Minnesota has a higher percentage of retiree age military retirees, in other words, over 65, than the national average. The national average is about 42%, 46% of our military retirees are above age 65. And we just lost the number dropped about 1,000 last year because World War II veterans are passing away, and we are not backfilling behind them. So the idea is to attract military retirees here at the time they are leaving the service.
We could just make it a no-income tax state. Wouldn't that help? Would that help, Commissioner, if we just got rid of the income tax in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, the list that Commissioner Salmoni referred to lists Minnesota is one of 8 states that taxes completely military retiree pay. 42 other states do something less than full taxing, from all the way from no taxation at all across the board. And I think there's 9 states like that. Or some.
I like A.
Yeah.
Anyway. Representative Lynchowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate you explaining the argument here for going that route. And if you have any information that you could provide me with to demonstrate the assertion that if we had these exemptions, then therefore more veterans would live here and we would get those benefits to our economy, and that's a compelling argument. My understanding is that Wisconsin has long had this exemption and has a fairly similar income tax system to us, and I don't know that they have a higher percentage. So if that's the case, it would sort of argue that it really doesn't make a difference when a state has that. So, you know, I would think you would have information that you could provide me to show that there is an effect on this kind of a policy.
Members, I know this is an important article, so we'll take a little bit of time, but I do want to try to move through as quickly as possible the rest of the provisions in the bill, because we also, on the schedule today, have the Department of Revenue's technical tax changes that we'd like to review. But anyway, again, I said, because this is an important article in the bill, Representative Severson, since you are the author of the legislation, you want to comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And it is. This is kind of what I call the job Z of human capital. And when we start looking at the retirees who are getting out of 20 or 30 years of the military, They have an option to go to any state they want, and when they go to their separation meeting, they are briefed on what the benefits are for each particular state. And they're briefed, and basically what they say is on a scale of 1 to 6, 1 being the most friendly, 6 being the least friendly, to a retiree from the military, Minnesota falls in the 6 category. And it's part of the process is because of this taxing, retirement pay, one of 8 states, as you've heard before. Currently, off the 2004 statistics, 295 million people in the United States, 1.9 retired, means that Minnesota should have about 33,000 retirees if it had its proportion of retirees. We have about 16,000. We have about half. Of those 16,000, they bring in over $220 million in federal dollars in revenue to the state from their retirement. And that's just that career. Now we're talking about moving on. We're talking about doctors, lawyers, supply guys. We're talking about people who have been in the military bringing federal benefits into the state. They've been in the military for 20, 30 years, and they're bringing that expertise and that leadership along with them. Wisconsin and California are both aggressively, and Florida are aggressively going after this population. In 2015, we are going to have about 46% of our state workers are going to be retiring. We have a huge need in the future for human capital. This job Z for human capital is an answer to that prospect. And so I appreciate the time of the members being able to take on this. I've got one testifier I'd like to bring forward, if that'd be all right.
It'd be fine, Representative Severson.
Good morning. Thank you very much. I've got a very short message, but I do think a compelling argument. I'm sorry. My name is Paul Wagner, Minnesota Wire and Cable, VESE Chapter AUSA, and Defense Alliance of Minnesota founder. I grew up in the streets of St. Paul. I was a Cretan kid, went to St. Thomas. I was lucky enough to buy my mom and dad's family business that had 14 people in the house, started at the kitchen table. We grew primarily in the computer age, and so the Chinese took that market from us, and then we went into the medical market for the last 15 years, continued to grow for wearable computers on the body. We're right next to the St. Paul Saints presently. We're 225 employees. We've hired 45 last year. Our plan calls to double our company within the next 4 years. That means I need another 200 people, in essence. Now, I started, we landed a program called Land Warrior, Wearable Computers for the Body, and it was 9-10 months after 9/11. We threw our heart and soul into it, and we just nailed it. Just Minnesota nailed it and got a reputation. So contracts started to come in. What I didn't have was access to soldiers. And so I started to volunteer out at AUSA, Association of U.S. Army. A couple guys getting together, etc. It's grown and grown. I'm now the chapter president. You show up, you volunteer, guess what happens? Okay. We got the best chapter in the country last year. Again, bringing Minnesota, a national voice, into that 110,000 membership strong. Now, that 1,000 members gave me access to guys in theater. You know, gave me inputs, design inputs, you know, because that's how you design and engineer fast, is the ones that are there have the best information. What we don't have is a draw, you know, on those people. I don't have access to that. I can't double my $8 million payroll unless I get access to veterans that want to live in Minnesota, and right now I don't have that. 24 months ago, I started an organization called Defense Alliance of Minnesota, primarily in order to bring jobs. Now, that organization, in a short period of time, grew to 260 companies, 1,650 members. Now, it gives me access to Murphy's at ATK and the General Dynamics and Lockheed's, et cetera. Those guys have problems because they don't have U.S. citizens, you know, that have degrees coming back. Most soldiers have not only degrees, but they got their citizenship as well. You know, but it gives me also access primarily to 240 smaller guys that are breeding jobs, and they need access to veterans. So bottom line, you know, is it's a good investment. You know, I can't do what I do as far as a job breeder unless I have a veteran-friendly state. That's the bottom line. And right now, we don't have a veteran-friendly state. I get a constant, you know, I don't want to go there because of my taxes. You know, that's a common breeder. So it's my compelling argument, but it's real life. It's on the streets of St. Paul. 2,500 guys that we serve down in Camp Shelby walk around with a kid on their shoulders, you know, and two in their hands, etc. Those guys are 33, 35-year-old staff sergeants that are coming back looking for work. And the best thing they're getting is training overseas with design inputs to breed high-end jobs and put them to work. You know, I've got a moral obligation of those guys to help out in the state of Minnesota. I'm not going to give up. I'd appreciate it if you guys wouldn't either. Thank you very much for giving me the 5 minutes, sir.
Welcome, Mr. Wagner. Thank you very much. Thank you, Representative Severson. Any further questions from committee members? Representative Yarrow.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I wonder if the federal government exempts military pensions from income tax. And I've had a couple of people that left Minnesota. One neighbor of mine from Duluth went to South Dakota, and he found out that he was paying more because in South Dakota, he pays sales tax on everything except haircuts and funerals. My Republican brother moved to Florida, found out the same thing. So are the veterans giving a full picture about taxes, property tax, sales tax, and so on? I have those two cases, but maybe, you know, I'm wrong.
Mr. Chair. What about the issue of federal exemption on military pension?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the federal income tax does apply to this pension income. That's why we would need a modification to exempt it in Minnesota, because it's included in federal taxable income. There are certain kinds of veterans' benefits that are not taxable, then Minnesota conforms to those federal rules. So, for example, you know, benefits, disability benefits, and those sorts of things.
Representative Severson, you want to respond to Representative Yaros?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Yaros. And currently, the way the federal pension is tax-exempt is through the VA. If there's a disability that's attained while you're in the service, there is a portion of your pension that is not taxed proportional to the amount of disability that you have received while in service in the government. Otherwise, that's taxed.
And Representative Severson, anything with regard to, as Representative Yaros is speaking of, that the overall tax burden, sales tax, property taxes, are those also included in the presentation to people who are leaving service?
Mr. Chair, members, it's about a three-day briefing, and typically they will go over the pros and cons, and we're given a large packet of information, and you've got to understand that this is purely a business decision. When they get out, they're looking at what place, and we have someone that can come and testify, a number of people who will testify that they couldn't come to Minnesota and start their business because they could not get retirees to come in and join them in that. And so we are losing that human capital. But again, it's a business decision that each of those members makes, and they are given the tools which best make that decision. And it was testified Minnesota has not typically been a very veteran-friendly state. This would go a long way to bring it to that point.
Do they include any meteorological data with that?
It's always a cloudy day.
Representative Earhart.
Well, it seems to me that what you guys could best do is get better weather in here. You're talking about California and Florida competing for these people. Well, they have other advantages that we don't have. But beyond that, Mr. Chairman, what's the question for you? Have you ever heard anybody besides veterans complain about the taxes in Minnesota? Yeah, and then say, well, we're going to go elsewhere and retire? About everybody you talk to, I'll answer it for you.
Representative Earhart, we have a number of people who complain about what the taxes are. So that's what I think we need to work on, getting rid of that income tax. Then we could attract them. We could be on the same par with Florida. So, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think there is a distinction, because while we know of, all of us have friends that go to Florida because of the tax situation or the tax break they get, and most of them go there for 6 months and a day because they still have a close affinity for Minnesota, it's important to listen to Representative Severson, because these military retirees are not at the end of their working day. They're retired from the military. They're not retired from the workforce. and I think that's a very important distinction. I also think I want to reiterate what Representative Severson stated, and these aren't things that are made up for Minnesota. These are things that are laid out for all retiring military personnel. Minnesota ranks as a class 6, where we should be closer to a class 1. We don't have to be first of the class there, but I think those distinctions need to be made. Thank you.
Representative Mullery.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner, I would assume that if we give tax breaks to anybody, it's going to be incentive to come here. It doesn't matter if we give tax breaks to on income to top bioscience experts no matter who we give tax breaks to, it's incentive to come here, and it's no different than this. We're just looking at what's trying to bring people in the state. There's no difference, but and I'm sorry I missed the beginning, but did you get into what percent of veterans would benefit by this?
Commissioner. Chair Representative Mullery, I didn't have a percentage, but I did use somewhere between 17,000 and 18,000 veterans who would benefit from this provision.
And I don't know this, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner. If you're only in, say, 4 years, do you benefit from this provision, or 2 years?
No, Mr. Chair, the way the bill is written, if you have a military pension, you would be qualified for this provision.
Mr. Chairman, I'm asking what that may be.
Representative Severson, you want to respond to the...
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mullery. No, you would not. You have to have retired. And one of the things that goes with that 20 or 30 year career is that every 3 years, those military members end up moving. So when typically people who are serving in the community, whether firefighters or their teachers or their policemen, have the opportunity to buy a house, and after that 20 or 30 years have that loan paid off, where the military member gets out after 20 or 30 years and comes into an immediate house payment. It also takes 3 years to earn the equity to make the money back on that house. So they're coming out when most people who have pensions their pension may not be taxed, or it is taxed, but they don't have to make a house payment. So when we're talking about the military person, they've made sacrifices not only of giving up capital and being able to create equity in a house, but they're also, you know, suffering with long deployments sometimes and being separation from family. Those are lives that we choose. We choose to do those things. But what we can do, and what gets back to this bill, is that we need to attract this human capital. We need to say, Minnesota wants you as a citizen to come here. Start your business here. Take a job here because we value your service and we also value your experience.
Mr. Chairman, to try and continue asking questions. Attracting human capital, as the commissioner already stated, we can do by giving all kinds of breaks. The commissioner of Veterans Affairs is up there. Would he know how many veterans there are in the state and how many this would apply to percentage-wise? Could he come down? Is that okay?
Sure. Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, the figures are given by the VA every year, and so they go down a little bit. So right now there's considered to be 426,591 veterans in the state. There's considered to be 16,027 military retirees. And of those, 7,413 are over the age of 65. So roughly 4% of our veterans population, it actually is 3.7, I think, 3.7 or 3.8% of our veterans population is military retirees.
Well,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. That maybe that's why I've talked to well over 100, well, way hundreds of veterans on this, and the only ones supporting it are some of the ones that get it, none of the others. The other rest of veterans don't agree with this, but do you know how many states do what you're suggesting, which is having all pensions taxed, but none on, but a total exclusion for veterans benefits.
Right now, that that category, there are three, of which one is Wisconsin, our next door neighbor.
And Mr. Chairman, since I brought this up to you, I see you've been doing your homework, Commissioner. then you could also, I assume, say how many states treat veterans' pensions the same way they treat all other pensions. I assume you know that and have the... You're about to read it, but just you want to put it on the record?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, there are 36 states that treat military and private pensions the same way. However, the important point to remember about that is that there's only 8 states that tax all private and military. So for a military retiree looking, or a soon-to-be military retiree, when they're making in the decision-making process, point is there's only 8 states that do what Minnesota does. So that makes that narrows the field, so to speak.
But Mr. Chairman,
plus you have to add in the wonderful weather we have, Representative Mullery. So
well, there are certain things in Minnesota that do discourage some people from coming here. But the point remains that in 36 states, they don't treat it any different from the general. Method of treating pensions in general, but that was, I wanted to put that on the record.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Representative Severson. Appreciate your being here and appreciate your testimony, as well as Mr. Wagner. Thank you. Commissioner Solomon, let's move on then.
Mr. Chair, we have about 4 more items here. I'll try to be brief. The next item is in Section 13 of the bill. It's the proposed dairy investment credit. This is a non-refundable credit against the individual and corporate income tax. It's a 10% credit of the first $500,000 of qualifying expenditures. These would be acquisition, construction, improvement of buildings and facilities, acquisition of equipment for dairy animal housing, confinement, animal feeding, milk production, and waste management. It applies to qualified expenditures only, which would be amounts capitalized or deducted under the Internal Revenue Code 167 or 179. The cost of the program is not capped. It applies to expenditures made between December 31st, 2005 and January 2nd, 2012. The credit can be carried forward for 15 years, the unused credit. The maximum credit for the 6-year period is $50,000. We estimate, based on a similar program in Wisconsin, that 2,200 farms would qualify for this credit in 2006. The fiscal impact in fiscal 06 and 07 is $4.7 million. Section...
Representative Earhart to the...
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I assume that this credit is to expand dairy production or build dairy farms. Is that the purpose of this?
Mr. Chair, the purpose of this credit is to encourage upgrading technology and capital investments in dairy farming, yes.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it was about 15 years ago when the federal government came in and bought out everybody's dairy farm they could get their hands on because we had overproduction. Now we're going the other way, or what?
Mr. Chair, this is focused on largely existing farms and providing them some assistance to modernize.
Well, is it, Mr. Chairman, is the federal government still discouraging the expansion of dairy products and farms, which they were doing not too many years ago?
Mr. Chair, I'm not up to date on my federal farm program. I know that there's a long history of the federal government being involved in price supports and other programs. I'm not sure.
I'm just curious if we're running at cross purposes here with another government program. Is there any dairy farmers in the crowd that can answer that?
Well, again, members, we did hear this legislation last year. It was in the House tax bill. We also had a hearing during the interim in up in Eden Valley, where we did have a number of farmers who came forward. I think if I might respond, Representative Earhart, the thing that I learned about this is that competition again with other states. So Wisconsin does have a similar program, and what is happening in some of the California dairy farmers is they are selling out or selling their land at largely escalated values, and they turn around and then move to either to other parts of California or to perhaps Montana, Idaho. They're able to put in large capital investments because of the increased value in their land. So it really becomes an issue, I think, of competition with our dairy farmers in competition with other dairy farmers around the country, and their ability to make these improvements where our farmers are, again, not able to equally compete in some of these areas. So, but you do raise a good question. What are we doing from the federal level? So we can hopefully get Representative Erdahl and others in here to help give us some background information on that. So, Representative Simpson, do you have a comment?
Just to that point, Mr. Chairman, and at this point I don't believe there is any type of federal dairy buyout. That was back in the mid-70s, and you're correct. It was at a time when we were seeing a great amount of dairy being produced. But Representative Krenke is all very correct in his assumption with you know, you talk about some of the issues about our military people looking at Florida and Texas and warm climates. Well, that's part of the issue we have in Minnesota, too, is producing a product with the various climates that we have. It makes it very challenging. But in rural Minnesota, these dairy herds are an important part of the fabric out there. And if we don't continue to have enough dairy herds throughout the state, we're going to be closing our dairy operations, such as our cheese plants or our milk plants and those types of things. So it's kind of a compounded industry, and I think that this bill gives just one more effort to try and maintain these farms. So thank you.
If there are no further questions on Section 13, Commissioner?
Next item is in Section 15. It's a citizenship credit. This is a refundable credit for non-citizens of the United States for expenses incurred during the naturalization process. Credit is available for taxpayer, spouse, and dependents. For qualified expenses paid between the time the taxpayer files a federal application to register permanent residence until the time the taxpayer becomes a citizen of the United States. Qualifying expenses include enrollment fees in English as a second language classes, citizenship application fees associated with the federal N-400 naturalization application. The credit is limited to $300 per family per year for households with less than $30,000 of adjusted gross income. We estimate that it will affect about 7,500 individuals who will benefit from the program out of about 40,000 immigrants over the age of 18. The fiscal impact in 06-07 is $1.1 million.
Representative Lucheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Salamone, I guess I have a similar question on this that to other issues that have been talked about today. Why not just appropriate grant money? This is basically, you know, I see an attempt to help low-income immigrants using the tax system to help them offset some of their costs for naturalization. In reading the fiscal note, the amount, and I'm not sure why that amount was picked, $300, that wouldn't even cover the application fee for naturalization, because the fiscal note says it's $400 per application, and that, of course, is just one part. There's the ESL classes, etc. Why didn't the administration just do a straight-up grant, use appropriations instead of using the tax system to achieve this policy goal?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lucheski, I can't answer that directly. I'm not sure the governor would have a strong feeling one way or the other. Should the committee choose to make an appropriation and go that route, maybe I could get more information for you.
Commissioner, I think that Representative Lynchesky does bring up a valid point here. Again, when we're always trying to manipulate the tax code to achieve certain ends, as you well know, it just makes the code much more complicated, much more difficult. And our goal is always simplicity, transparency. So, not sure we're achieving our goal, but anyway. Other questions?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I mean, is there such a great, you know, do they need an incentive? I became a citizen. I couldn't wait to vote. That's why mainly I did it. And there are benefits that are not pecuniary. I don't know why we have to reward people financially for becoming a citizen. I think it's there already are many advantages besides the little bit of money. I would hope that that's why people would want to become citizens, for, you know, because it's a good thing, not because it's $300.
Okay, any I think that finishes the summary or the overview of House File 3603. I'm sorry, two other things?
Very briefly, Mr. Chair, there are two other items in the bill. One that you're all very familiar with, Section 17, is an acceleration of the phase-in of single sales factor. It's a three-year acceleration. We're currently on an eight-year phase-in of the 100% weight on sales. Under this proposal, we would be at 100% sales in the year 2011 as opposed to 2014. I think this provision enjoys a wide support up here at the legislature. The cost of accelerating it by 3 years is $1.7 million in the current biennium. When it's fully phased in, in the 08-09 biennium, it's $21.1 million. It rises a little after that and then phases down to zero.
Commissioner, what was the recommendation from the governor last year with regard to phase-in of single sales?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Manson reminds me that it was an eight-year phase-in last year, as proposed by the governor.
So, Commissioner, what changed from last year to this year?
Mr. Chair, as you know, there's a little more money on the table to be used for various good deeds, and this is a proposal that everyone, when we did the enactment of the eight-year phase, and there was, I think, wide support that if we had money, we would have done it faster, and now there's a little more money, and I think the governor wants to do that.
Okay. Let's continue then.
The final item, Mr. Chair, is found in sections 20 through 23. This is a sales tax exemption for improvements to resorts. It provides a sales tax exemption of up to $10,000 per resort per year for construction materials and supplies for physical expansion or capital improvements to Class 1C, which are small resorts, and Class 4C, which are the larger commercial resorts. The proposal would apply to the CI portion of resorts as well. It would be basically an up, it would not be an upfront exemption. It would be handled much like the manufacturing capital equipment exemption. The fiscal cost of this proposal would be about $880,000 in the current biennium. As I understand it, Mr. Chair, the number of resorts in Minnesota in 1970 was 2,500. And today there are about 1,000 resorts, so the issue here is to try to provide some support for improvements in those properties that are a big part of the tourism industry in Minnesota.
Representative Abrams.
Well, you know, Mr. Chair, you know, I try to support the governor literally in every way possible, but I can think of a lot of businesses in my district that are essential, and updating their plant and equipment or whatever is just as essential to the economy of the western suburbs as the resorts are to northern Minnesota. And then the proposal, I think, would be either the second or the third refundable credit. There's the political contribution credit. There is the sales tax capital replacement equipment refund, and then this. I'm just trying to figure out where this went to, and particularly after we cut those small resort taxes. Geez, you know,
I was amazed at how little they paid before the cuts, and they got 50-60% tax reduction. So, you know, why this on top of the property tax reductions last year, Commissioner?
Representative Abrams, I think we have to look at where the governor might be going this summer. I don't know, maybe he wants a little upgrade in the particular resort location or something.
I don't get it. Maybe Salamone has
some. Commissioner, do you have some insight for us?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Where the governor may be vacationing this summer or something?
I can't share any of that. I don't have the information, Mr. Chair.
It didn't emanate from the department. You weren't sitting around in your office, Commissioner, and saying, gee, what are the 100 biggest problems facing the taxpayers in Minnesota? And sales tax refunds for small resort improvements just emanated from the department and was under your top 100 list, Commissioner. I think I know a little bit better, so I'm trying to figure out the genesis of this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abrams, I'm a tax administrator. I'm not in touch with various industries in Minnesota, except when they get into trouble with the Department of Revenue. We have a number of rough spots in our tax system, and I think the governor, just looking on the margin, trying to help this industry expand. I don't know that I can say much more than that.
It's a small margin, Representative Abrams. Representative Murray.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you know, we're talking about trying to help people expand. Why aren't you giving the same kind of a credit to businesses that will go into inner city, very low income areas or something? Why aren't we giving it to where it's really needed, not something like this? I mean, if you're going to come up with an idea, why aren't we going where there's some real extreme need for it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullerly, there are a lot of good causes we could spend money on, and you raise a good question. If we had more money, I suppose we could look at that. Everyone has their own priorities. You're all going to make some decisions and set priorities. The governor has done his bit. He went through and identified where he would like to invest some money and reasons. The committee's going to do the same thing.
Then it's either department or a governor's decision that it's more important to help these small resorts than to help businesses going into low-income areas that are needed there for both jobs and for service to people there.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think it's a matter of cycling through various needs. We can't do everything at one time with the limited funds that we have. Last year we had a different set of priorities. The year before that we had a different set of priorities, and we'll probably get around to unfinished business in future years. We can't do everything at one time.
The follow-up, then, why don't we shift to that then as a priority compared to the resorts?
Mr. Chair, as I said a minute ago, the governor has made his decisions based on what he felt were the most pressing needs and the best use of the limited funds that he had available. You're all going to do the very same thing.
Okay. Representative Simpson.
Well, I think just to Representative Mullery's point, there's no question that you have a good point and there is a need there. But I think if you look at the history of 4,000 resorts down to 900, we have a situation here that if we don't do things, and we did a good thing last year in the tax committee with reducing the tax on these resorts. But if we don't do some more things to continue trying to save them, they're not going to be here. So in another 10 years, Representative Mullery, we probably won't have this as an issue. They just won't be out there. So I think that's where the governor's coming from. So.
Do you want to make a comment?
Sure.
Just go ahead. Let's let the testifier make a comment, then Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Edmond. I'm Director of Explore Minnesota Tourism, and maybe I can help answer some of your questions regarding where this idea came from. First of all, as you know, tourism is a huge industry. There are many huge industries in the state. Tourism does bring about $1 billion back every year in new state and local taxes to our economy. Without some of these properties and resorts, that's money that will be lost to the state of Minnesota. This idea of a resort sales tax exemption came from the various resort associations, the Congress of Minnesota Resorts, the Minnesota Resort and Campground Association, because they were looking at a program called the Tourism Loan Program that existed several years ago and that was eliminated during some of the budget crunches. As opposed to just asking for a direct appropriation for that program, they looked at it a different way. And the benefits of this resort sales tax exemption, it benefits more resorts. It also has a smaller cost to the state of Minnesota than putting, say, $1 million, $2 million into a tourism loan program. So it was looked at as a relatively economical way to help resorts. What we're losing the number, help to provide access to resources, because as all of you know, finding a cabin on a lake is not as easy as it used to be. There's many, many more private homes being developed. And I think there is a policy decision on access to resources to the outdoors as well as to the economic impact. And that's, Mr. Chairman, where this whole proposal came from.
No, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Mullery and then Representative Daniel. Okay.
Representative Mullery, I just wanted to retort to Representative Simpson, my good friend. I think we still have to get you up to the north side, and you're talking about down to one out of four still open. If you can find one out of 20 small businesses up there, that would be wonderful. You have to come to where the reality is in this state in some places and see it.
Representative Abrams, now we know where the idea originates.
Now I know what the idea originates, but I think members ought to get an idea of what they're voting for if, in fact, this makes it through. Ms. Dalton, in looking at the language on page 21, lines 1 through 7, if I'm a small resorter and I'm getting my roof redone, which has to be done once every 20 or 25 years, is that making a capital improvement and subject to the sales tax exemption?
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abrams, if you are doing it on a cabin, yeah, it would qualify.
And Mr. Chairman, Ms. Dalton, if I were to put up a sign that had Pat and Ron's Resort, a new sign, and expended money for the wood and other sales tax items, would the new sign be subject to the sales tax exemption?
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abrams, I believe it would.
And Mr. Chairman, Ms. Dalton, if you were to replace some cracked windows, and I know there's a lot of cracked windows in Representative Mullery's district, as I used to work there. if you replace the cracked window, would that be a capital improvement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abrams, I believe it would be.
So we're not talking about physically expanding. We're just talking about regular maintenance items would be making a capital improvement. Am I correct, Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, given that there isn't really a definition of capital improvement in here, I would think you would be.
Mr. Chair. Representative Abrams, do you have any more examples you want to provide to committee members?
Well, I wasn't going to get into heating and air conditioning, Mr. Chairman, if that's a question.
Representative Rukawina.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think the point being, Representative Mullery, and I know, you know, times are tough in the urban parts of this state as they are in the rural parts. But these 900 or so resorts that are still out there, a lot of pressure has been put on them to just bust them up and sell lakeshore lots, which is what has happened to a lot of them. And when I was driving milk truck for the Tower Dairy, Representative Abrams, I remember all those resorts on Lake Vermilion. There's hardly any of them left anymore. And so I think this was a proposal by, you know, the Department of Tourism to to help out and try to keep those resort owners from busting them up because they're trying to make a living out there. But Representative Abrams, you know, when you were the chair of the tax committee and Representative Rest was the chair of the tax committee, I'd watch every new peaking electrical plant come in here and get a sales tax rebate, you know, on this and that. And, you know, we've given them all the time. I think on capital improvements, we cut sales tax a few years ago for all kinds of businesses. So, you know, I mean, we can talk about, I don't know, I have a lot of constituents that don't have cabins that dream about spending a week with their family. I don't have any constituents that don't think that dreamed about spending a week in North Minneapolis. But for their vacation, but that may be a whole different subject. So, I mean, it's trying to preserve a Minnesota tradition, and, you know, I just had to jump in. I was hoping Representative Dill could come in here to defend his resort, since I don't believe I may have one or so in my district.
They're a Republican, so you don't care.
No, I think we no, actually, they're all right.
Representative Muller, are you ready to start the tax exemption program for a visit for a week in North Minneapolis?
Mr. Chairman, we can introduce you to a new form of hunting that all these macho hunters out there... in Northside, they shoot back at what you're hunting. But it's funny that Representative Rukavina basically says, why would anybody want to go to North Minneapolis, when on his wall is a certain picture of a great son of North Minneapolis, Floyd B. Olson. And he apparently thinks highly of the products from the North Side.
Mr. Chair, I think highly of Representative Mullery. And former Representative...
You're going to put him on your wall, too?
Yes, he's trying.
What do you have to do to get on the wall?
But my point being, if there were specific businesses that were, there in North Minneapolis, I would certainly like to help them out. But these businesses already exist. They're disappearing. That was the point of the sales tax rebate for resorters.
Well, Representative Murray.
If you add to Representative Rukavina, there's businesses disappearing constantly in North Minneapolis.
Well, Representative Mallory, I think you should get them together and ask for a sales tax exemption. We'd support you.
Well, we'll get one. That's pretty.
Yeah, exactly.
Got to move that Twin Stadium a little further north, Representative Mullery, so we get some economic development moving.
Chairman, on another item.
Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, before you set off the fire alarm last week, Commissioner Salamone, I was asking you a question about the $7 million in tax expenditures that was not subject to a chair letter. Is larger than the usual items, and I'd like to hear the department's justification for basically sua sponte in your own motion, just doing it without any legislative oversight whatsoever. And I will point out that under both Senator Johnson and Senator Pogomiller, and under all the House taxpayers I'm familiar with, we may have had questions about individual items, but those chair letters were routinely signed as a matter of good policy. But, this dollar number is much higher than normal and didn't go through that process. Could you explain why not and kind of give us some assurance that you will try to go through at least talking to the chairs and perhaps the ranking majority leader, minority leaders on committees in the future?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abrams, you're right. It was an unusual year. First, let me say we did send letters to both chairs. But I think this is a year was unique in several respects. First, we didn't get a definite answer back from the chairs in terms of, yes, we want you to do this or this. But more importantly, and by the way, we certainly will commit to being very aggressive in getting a signal from the chairs in the future. We've always done letters to the chairs when there was a decision to be made about conformity for the purpose of tax forms, not the law. The law still needs to be either conformed or non-conformed. And Representative Abrams, I don't agree with the statement you made that the money's out the door. And if you make a decision not to conform, then we will contact taxpayers and tell them they need to amend returns. We've already warned them about the potential of that, and we'll get that money in. What was different this year was they had very late federal bills, retroactive federal bills. The latest one, the Gulf Opportunity Zone bill, was December 21st of 05. So we have decisions to make about the tax form, and it's true that historically that's been a joint decision of the governor, the two tax chairs, and the department. And that's the way I would like it to be every year. But this year there are a number of factors that made that difficult, and we needed to make a decision. One reality is nowadays that because of electronic filing, the deadline for getting forms to the software vendors is October 1st, at least a good first draft. And shortly thereafter, we need to finalize it. So I was concerned about having a delay in getting the tax forms out. And the only regret I have, Mr. Chair and Representative Abrams, is that I didn't camp out on the doorstep of both tax chairs' offices and the governor's office to get a clear signal on what their preferences were. These were small, relatively small dollar items. Granted, they added up to $7 million, which was historically maybe bigger than some of the other items. So it wasn't our best hour, I admit that, and I apologize to the committee. And we'll move forward, hopefully, with much more consultation.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Any further questions from committee members on House File 3603? Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment to the commissioner, and I appreciate all the time you spent going through the governor's tax proposal, and I think we all understand it better now. I have to say that I personally think it's a disappointment. I think the big issues before the tax committee this year ought to be standard deduction, which you have addressed, and that's kudos there. AMT, which Representative De La Forest mentioned, there's really nothing there, and I agree with him, it should have been addressed. But property tax relief, I think, is the biggest issue out there, and there's really no property tax relief in this bill. I know it's been asserted that levy limits are property tax relief, but I just have to disagree. And I just, you know, I noticed in looking at the fiscal note, I mean, I think I figured out why some things made it in certain forms, and it's really that you don't have to appropriate, you just cut taxes. And the follow-up for us will be in the future, if this were to pass, is that there's, I think, $87 million in tails. I mean, we're going to collect less income tax, we're going to collect less corporate tax, and we're going to collect less general sales and use tax, according to this proposal. And I think when you net it all out, it makes the tax system more regressive, not more progressive, and you've got the tails problem. And there's no property tax relief. So, you know, I know it's a starting point. Again, I personally think it's a disappointment. I look forward to the House's omnibus tax bill. I know that it's been asserted by the Speaker and many others that there will be property tax relief. So we'll be looking forward to that. And I wonder, Mr. Chair, if you could just tell us what your plan is calendar-wise for an omnibus tax bill from the House, when you're looking to do that, when markup might be, those kind of initiatives, just for calendar planning.
Representative Lincheski was going to make make those announcements at the end of the meeting, but I can certainly tell everyone now that what we first of all are doing is we are referring a number of bills down to the division. The division has been doing a lot of work on a variety of pieces of legislation. They will be meeting on Wednesday and Thursday this week. And next week, at the behest of the Speaker, we are going to be taking up baseball. It's the baseball season started yesterday throughout the major leagues, so the baseball season will start next week here in the Tax Committee. So don't miss it. It'll be a lot of fun and excitement. I don't know who's bringing the peanuts and the popcorn, but
sure. Hitter? Or
I'm the fiery right-hander, starting for the taxpayers. So the people that pay the bills, Representative Rukavina, who I'm here to represent. hopefully we got a few lefties warming up in the bullpen.
Southpaw.
anyway, that's that'll be some of the fun and excitement starting next week. So, Representative Lynchewski, we will be starting ardent work on tax issues in the committee and markup bill after the Easter Passover break. That will be from I believe it's the 13th through the 17th, something. Yeah. So. Simples.
Regarding that, then, the scheduling issue for next week, do you foresee having a day or so of testimony and then marking up the bill? I mean,
we will have the proponents who will be up at bat first, and then we will have the opponents, and then we'll have time for committee testimony and amendments. So,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rookfina.
Are we working on any touchdown passes, or are we sticking to baseball?
Well, Representative Rookfina, it's obviously up to the purview of the committee. There's one of our members who has been a big supporter of working with the Vikings and moving their initiative forward. So perhaps Representative Westerberg will have some little surprises for us in our Easter baskets as we work on this legislation.
Mr. Chair, as one who has been very fair here, we could end up with a, like Representative Hackworth still left the committee.
Well, Representative Rukavina, the State Government Finance Committee, had to do a little sanding on that bill this morning, so it's not quite the same shape that it left the past. So, again, that's just for members. If you have any questions, or we don't have the exact schedule for what we will be doing on the April 10th and 11th with regard to the Twins stadium legislation, but we will get that to you as soon as possible. So, members, okay. Back to Representative Abrams, a question for the Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Salamone, what happens if there isn't an omnibus tax bill this year? Does the sun still rise in the east and set in the west? What issues would you view as critical, such that if there was no omnibus tax bill, that the world wouldn't be quite as good a place?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, essential.
We entertain the fantasy every year that there might not be a tax bill, and I don't know that we've ever had a year without one. But to your question, I personally could live without a tax bill, but it's not my decision, and I know there are important issues that some of us might want to address. I think for the department, the most important thing would be federal conformity, to try to get some legislation one way or the other on that. If you choose not to conform, that would be the outcome of a no tax bill. We would then move forward to get taxpayers to amend their tax year 05 filings. But beyond conformity, I'm not so sure. In terms of the operation of the department, there would be any big impact. Obviously, the governor has some priorities he'd like to see addressed, from my perspective as the tax administrator, I think we could live with a decision on conformity, and even without one, I suppose.
Well, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Abrams.
I would hope that all members of both bodies would listen very carefully to the words of Commissioner Salamone. We can either get real serious about trying to do the must-do list and maybe three or four other things that are for the good of the order, or we can play political games like fourth tiers and cuts that aren't sustainable and that sort of thing. I mean, I guess it's up to the body, both bodies, as to how serious they are about doing a bill, but I guess I take from the commissioner that outside of some federal conformity items, which, you know, I would agree with the commissioner from administration point of view, administrator's point of view is important, there is just no must-do list, so I guess it's kind of up to us if we want to try to get something done.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abrams, that's exactly where I'm going and where Representative Lynchewski started. We came into this session talking about property tax relief. All I have heard about have been levy limits. doesn't do anything for the folks. There's a lot of families that saw 15, 20, 25% increases in their property taxes, not just in my district, but all throughout the state of Minnesota. Brings to mind that elderly lady that was in the TV commercial that said, "Where's the beef? Where's the relief?" Is my question. We keep, you know, we've been at this now for a couple months, folks, and levy limits don't do anything about what people have faced this year. I would pose it as a question. I mean, I'm not trying to make a speech here, but Mr. Chair or Commissioner Salamone, when are we going to actually see some property tax relief? Is there a game plan with respect to that?
Well, Representative Atkins, might seem like it's a couple of months, but we've really only been here a month.
Feels like a couple of months. No longer every day. Extra innings.
So, Representative Earhart.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, can somebody, either Commissioner, Representative Abrams, or yourself, tell me what really necessitates a tax bill as far as conformity and so forth? I'm looking at the bill here. Alternative minimum tax certainly would be nice. The marriage penalty would certainly be nice. Are those on either one of your lists, or which ones?
Commissioner, would you like to address or prioritize what you believe the most important federal conformity issues perhaps would be?
Mr. Chair, I think there's widespread support for doing something with the marriage standard deduction. I think that's one that has the biggest impact in terms of numbers of taxpayers. Beyond that, it's sort of nice to do things in terms of simplicity for the taxpayer, but they don't rise to the level of the marriage standard deduction.
Anybody else? Mr. Chairman, I would like to add to that.
Representative Abrams, you want
to... Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, if you look at Section 8 of the bill, there's the federal update, which costs roughly $7 million. And I think that there's some in Section 9 and some in Section 11.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With due deference to Representative Earhart, asked a good question. I never heard an answer to mine. I didn't mean it as a rhetorical question. I really meant it either to you, Mr. Chair, if you've got some insight relative to the property tax relief proposals that may be coming forward, or more likely, perhaps, Commissioner Salamone.
I have not had a great deal of time to study what the Senate did. I've heard a lot of people talking about property tax relief. I don't believe there was any property tax relief in the Senate bill that was brought forward last week. I have not seen legislation that's been introduced by members that has brought forward a lot with regard to substantive property tax relief. My retort in our caucus and when with the media is that we tried almost $3 billion of property tax relief in last year's tax bill. How much more relief do you want? And where is it going to go? So that's what this committee gets to determine. So as I said, put your thinking caps on. Talk to the advisor's office, talk to tax staff. Let's go, folks. If you want property tax relief, then let's put the legislation forward and let's come up with a plan that truly, I think we all know that property tax has been discussed around this building since they first put them on the books. we can all talk about why the increases in property taxes, but we need to get down to something specific with regard to what are you going to do to provide some specific type of quote-unquote relief. Representative Rukumi.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think
I'm
that...
I'm sorry. Let Representative Atkins respond.
I'm
polite,
but I... Mr. Chair, if that's relief that we did last year, I don't want any. Not just speaking for myself, but everybody I ran into saw 15, 20, 25% increases in their property taxes everywhere. Like I say, I haven't, perhaps Commissioner Salamone might know better, but I kept waiting, and I'm not in the Senate. frankly, don't want to be in the Senate.
Well, Representative Atkins, I believe if we bring out the roll call vote from last year, you voted against the property tax freeze.
Okay.
I offered a property tax freeze in this committee, and the committee rejected that idea. So now you come back and say, well, gee, property taxes went up. And you know, Representative Atkins, that a substantial portion of the property tax increase is due to valuation increases. So, if, you know, I'm here. We'll be willing to hear every idea, every proposal of what you want to do with property taxes. So, but again, to look back and say, well, they went up and it was the fault of the legislature, I don't think that's a totally accurate situation. So what do we want to do about them? We'll decide starting about April 18th.
Now, Mr. Chair, did I once say that it's the fault of the legislature? Did I point fingers at anybody? I didn't do that.
there are some people out there, Representative Atkins, that have, but anyway.
And my methinks that's protest too much, but my point in raising it is I kept hearing about, you know, the governor's got a proposal for property tax relief, the House is going to do some property tax relief. I just haven't seen anything. It was an honest question about where is the relief.
Well, Representative Atkins, my view of the situation of what has happened is when the property tax, when the truth in taxation statements came out, there was a response by the governor and by leadership of both caucuses and both bodies saying we're going to do property tax relief. Okay? And now what we see is that the governor doesn't have any property tax relief other than, he said, talk about whether levy limits are property tax relief or not. Okay. But there's no direct property tax relief in the governor's proposal. We've seen that, what we have. As I said, my understanding of what is in the Senate bill is there's no direct property tax relief in the Senate proposal. So I guess that if we want property tax relief, it's up to the House.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just a moment here, folks. Okay, Representative Lanning was next on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To this point, when you look at the issue of property tax relief, where taxes went up the most is in the school property tax. Statewide, it was over 16%. All property tax overall was a little over 9%, as Commissioner Salamone could attest. Education finance is going to come forward, I believe, with some specific proposals that would provide property tax relief with regard to education levies. And my question, Mr. Chairman, of you is, will you be asking to hear those proposals that come out of education finance?
Traditionally, any bill that comes out of the Education Finance Committee which affects property tax levies comes to the Tax Committee, and I would assume that we would follow that tradition this year as well.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So that, it seems to me, addresses Representative Atkins' point that we are going to be seeing some property tax relief, especially with regard to school taxes.
Representative Rukavina.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think, you know, a lot of what we have done around here recently has caused the increase in property taxes. The Representative Dorman last year several times attempted to replace some of the local government aid monies that directly impacted property taxes in a lot of communities. I believe I saw 3 years ago, Albert Lee's property taxes went up 18%, or was it 2 years ago? What we've done here has directly affected Representative Atkins' local property taxes. Today, in one of my school districts, Mesabi East, is voting on an excess levy because of their declining enrollment and actual, you know, flat funding for education has forced them to go to the voters, and I hope that they pass their excess levy, but it's going to have a significant impact. Last year in the Virginia School District, we passed an excess levy, finally, after many attempts to keep our curriculum and everything going, and it's had a significant impact on local property taxes in my area. The property tax statements came out the other day, and you know, the school district portion went up considerably. So what we do here has a impact, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Salamone, I'm taken aback that that property tax relief going up, property taxes going up as they are in this whole state, is on the back burner of the governor's budget or tax proposal. So I hope that this committee does look at property tax relief. And Mr. Chair, we've tried. When you cut $120 million a year out of local government aid and put back 40 or whatever it was, and then there's no adjustment for inflation, it has a significant impact on taxes. And $3 billion, Mr. Chair, I don't know what, you know, that number was, and if you adjust it to inflation before a few years back, but I'm sure that that figure was a lot higher as far as property tax relief.
Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to comment that you said that property taxes went up because property valuations went up, but property valuations don't necessarily, I mean, that doesn't, it's property taxes set without regard to the property valuations, so them going up doesn't affect property tax.
Is that what the local units of government tell their residents?
Well, no, Mr. Chairman. They tell them what you said, but I don't think that that's true.
Okay.
I'm
just repeating what
your local mayor said.
Yeah, I'm just repeating what the mayor said when I walked into his office.
Okay.
Okay. Members, the...
Mr. Chair.
Someone, Representative Lachesky.
Mr. Chair, I know you're trying to get to the technical bill, but I did just hear you say that you'll hear, you know, all these pieces of property tax relief, and just looking really fast at all the bills that have been referred to taxes, I do want people to realize that there have been bills introduced in these areas. Representative Bernardi can speak for herself, but she's tried to address the school levy issue in a bill that she has, and I know LGA, we have Representative Sandy Peterson and Representative Steven this biennium have both put bills in, and we have, I know Representative Scalzi is being scheduled tomorrow on market value credit, paying that, but Representative Marquardt has a bill on that as well, and there have been renter's credit and circuit breaker proposals as well yet to be heard for seniors and, you know, all kinds of areas within that. So there are a lot of proposals in that area, and I think Representative Atkins is, you know, I'm guessing, but, I mean, you know, he's trying to get at when are we going to get at that, and I appreciate that you said that they would get hearings. I know Representative Vandiver has heard a couple, and I'm glad to hear that maybe we'll be getting to all those other sort of property tax relief proposals yet before we get to an omnibus bill.
Well, I know that Representative Vandiver has taken quite a bit of time to hear. I don't know the number of bills dealing with local option sales tax, so it seems to me that people are more interested in raising their taxes on their local citizens than they are working to reduce their taxation levels. So, again, it's hard to figure out which direction people want to go. People talk about tax relief, but then at the same time they're talking about tax increases, and I think... we had Representative Hackbar's bill that came in to this committee, a constitutional amendment on dedication of sales tax, left here as a sales tax increase. And while it was a constitutional amendment, so it seems to me it seems to be more of an appetite to raise taxes than it does seem to be to provide tax relief to people. So, unless you call tax relief taxing somebody else to give you relief, but maybe that means that's what the. Okay.
That's how it always works.
I'm glad I hit the right button there, Representative Rigovina. Okay. Representative Rigovina, would you like to move the minutes from the Tuesday, March 28th meeting?
Mr. Chair, yes, I would.
Any comments, corrections to the minutes of the Tuesday, March 28th meeting? If not, all those in favor of the minutes as written signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those who are opposed? Members, we don't have a lot of time left here, but is there anyone in the audience who wants to make a comment? We said we're not taking amendments or obviously voting on House File 3603. Anyone in the audience who wants to make a comment or a statement, please come forward. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bill Hargis, Mayor of Woodbury, and I'm here in my capacity of chair of the Municipal Legislative Coalition, which is a group of 13 suburban communities with demographics similar to Woodbury. It's been alluded to your comments, I think, last time about levy limits. I'm here to testify on behalf of the MLC that levy limits don't work. You know, you've indicated there, for our cities, there's really no state aid, no local government assistance. Having levy limits, I think, are contrary to local control, local accountability, and they're not a good financial tool because they work contrary to your the purposes, and I think they're inconsistent, as I mentioned, with local government, local control. We have a very open budget process in the city of Woodbury, as do all of our member cities. A lot of talk about workshops, through workshops, articles. We use 10-year financial projections, 5-year capital improvement plans. We have limitations that we put on ourselves for our growth and per household expenditures. So there's many tools to manage. We have a couple major increases that we've had in recent years deal with. We have a significant increase in investment in our road maintenance. We went through a committee, a citizen committee, that came up with some guidelines and recommendations. That's one thing we're able to do. Also, we made a significant investment in our public safety deal. That, again, came through a citizens committee, and that's what our feedback was. We believe in very much accountability to our residents. We think levy limits are contrary to that principle, contrary to the principle of local control, and contrary to good long-term financial planning. So we're here to say that levy limits don't work. We think the system that's in place, I'm only a phone call or people popping into my office all the time, and people have had questions over the years about their taxes. We're able to sit down with them and work with them, where if they have questions about our overall big picture spending, we invite them into our process and that. So I don't think has been alluded to, levy limits don't work, and in fact they can become targets, because if you're going to be a good financial manager and you're going to raise your taxes to maximize your levy limits, and if you do have levy limits, you really penalize those that make a choice in 1 year to be efficient in that. So just on behalf of the Municipal Legislative Coalition, we want to make clear our position that we're opposed to levy limits. So thank you for your time and your work on behalf of the citizens of our great state.
Thank you. Additional questions? If not, okay.
Chairman, my name is Glenn Dorfman. I represent the Minnesota Realtors. I'd like to reiterate what the mayor said. We've opposed levy limits and all the gimmicks for years. We'll still oppose them. You probably do them anyway. This is a political year, but I would, and nothing that we say is going to have much influence on that, but I would urge everybody to take a look at the July 13th Pat Dalton memo to interested parties. Many of us read actually what your house research puts out, and we could certainly cut down on some of the rhetoric if we look at this. Runs too, rather than 30% increases in Dakota County, for example, there were 17% increases, 10% of which was home value increases, which means the net worth of the people in Dakota County are up 10%. And I know you guys don't like this, but this memo says that cities like Minneapolis did very well because of the additional $48 million in LGA. And to the degree that it's possible, and I implore both sides of the aisle to do this, all we're going to do is get ourselves into an additional mess by spending money we don't have. And then next year, voila, we'll arrive back. We have a projected 10.7% increase in revenue in the budget. Home values are declining statewide, and they're declining at a rate that should make commercial values are going up by about double. So in the city of Minneapolis, for example, I would guess that next year you will see fairly substantial increases in commercial taxes and a fairly substantial reduction in residential taxes. So what we put in place, everybody wants to argue about the 2001 reforms. They're bad and they're icky, even though everybody voted for them, I might add. But they actually are working. And Representative Rukavina, I don't want to create any ire between us because I happen to like you, but I looked on the range. I got to tack on it. This is a run from House Research, not my run, not some private run. This is a House Research run, which I think we all agree. Steve Hines, 220-206. Pay 2005, final pay 2005, actual pay 2006, and the range cities show on homes a $50,000 home went up 7% in value, and its taxes went up $4. And on average value, $75,400 to $880,000, value went up 7%, tax went up $27. On a high value, $100,000 to $107,000, this is not Lakeshore, and I'm sensitive to that, I appreciate that. But the taxes, the value went up 7%, and the tax went up 40%, and on an extra high value, $150,000 to $161,000, the value went up 7%, and the taxes went up $61. And this is true in the suburbs, and it's true in the cities, and you guys did do some good work last year in LGA, and it's in Pat Dalton's memo, and I just don't understand. I mean, I understand politics. I've been around a long time. But I don't understand the fact that we're going to do irresponsible things, like commit money that we don't have, and then next year wonder why we don't have enough money to fund early childhood education. So I got to fulfill my role every year of making you mad. But I really think there needs to be some responsibility, because the people in Minnesota got this figured out. We're not going to convince everybody they're paying high property taxes, because the fact of the matter is they're not, number one. And number two, the taxes they pay on the value increase that they get is the best tax they pay. On a $10,000 increase in value, they pay $200 in property taxes. On a $10,000 increase in income, they pay $25,000 to $3,000. And you can deduct your property taxes, you can't deduct your sales taxes, which everybody voted for to do a constitutional amendment, right? Sales tax not deductible, property tax is. That's it. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Orphan. It is past the hour, 12 o'clock. We have session, so we will stand adjourned.